Hi, this is Des from Intercom. I'm recording the first in what I expect to be a series of interesting interviews. Last year in Boston at the Business of Software, I was delivering a workshop about customer experience and designing for long-term loyalty. The keynote at that conference absolutely blew my mind. It was Professor Clay Christensen. His theory of market disruption, which I covered recently on the blog, was compelling, but probably the most fascinating takeaway for me was the idea that he introduced of jobs to be done. I wrote about this recently in a post titled Focus on the Job, Not the User, and I'm absolutely delighted to be joined on the line by the self-titled milkshake man, Bob Muesta, who works for Clay and has years of experience applying this line of analysis, helping businesses improve their products with his company, the Rewired Group. Bob, it's great to have you.
Thank you. Very, very nice to be here.
Thank you. So can you just maybe give our readers or listeners a quick background of what the Rewired Group does, a level you're comfortable with, and maybe your role within the group?
Yeah, so our business actually is set up into two different areas. One area is that we basically help large Fortune 500 companies develop, find innovation, find white space, and help them develop new products and services to go into those white space based on the jobs to be done framework. The other half of the business is an incubator where we help technology companies, basically become interim management or, help them basically build and scale their businesses. So half the time we're entrepreneurs and the other half the time we're consultants. I think we all love to be more entrepreneurial. At the same time, the big Fortune 500 provides us insights into both problems and issues of trying to bring innovations to market. So we actually like to do both.
It's a split that most of our listeners will be very, very familiar with, because most software startups tend to be like to start off as the side projects of consulting. And whether they like it or not, the consulting is actually what teaches you an awful lot about the market that you're going to enter.
Exactly. We actually, when we work with Fortune 500, we exclude ourselves from any of the verticals that we work in. So we work in consumer packaged goods, we do some stuff in medical device, we do some stuff in education. So all the startup stuff we do is not in those spaces. So we just make sure we stay far away from kind of the conflict of interest space.
Sure. Okay, so looking specifically at jobs to be done, it seems to have hit upon a wave of like incredible popularity lately. Like since I first heard it back in Boston and started following up on it, I've seen numerous blogs, analysts, designers, entrepreneurs, everyone from like Asimco, Horace Dedue's podcast, which you were on recently, true to Ryan Singer, the product manager at 37 Signals. A lot of people seem to be really, really grasping this idea. And yet, when I read about it, I sort of see like that in a lot of the articles about it, some of the examples date back to like maybe the 80s, early 90s. Is there something in the air now that you think is it the right time for jobs to be done thinking, or has it always been here?
I think it's always been here. I think one of the interesting things is that So I literally was in the consulting business till about 99 and then decided to just go apply it. So in building three startups and selling them, utilizing the framework and doing those things, it's just been very powerful. I actually got very frustrated in trying to teach people how to use it. And to be honest, Clay reached out about 3 years ago and said, I need some help. He goes, I really think it's an important concept and people we've been trying to apply in different places, but you live and breathe it. It's pretty much part of my DNA. And so he asked me to come back and help in both the medical space and in the education space. And so he basically, gave me the opportunity to kind of think about, I need to give back. And when Clay asks for help, I always respond.
Absolutely.
So, In that case, I think part of the popularity is coming forward for, I think, three different reasons. I think the first reason is I think Clay is actually promoting it a lot more, and I think that it is an essential part of disruptive innovation that products get pulled into scenarios or situations or jobs that they're not really suited to do, but at the same time, as the market struggles to make progress, we settle for certain things. And so I think that it's very hard for, from a marketing perspective to market the product, but yet, find places where people are using it in extreme situations and realize that that's an opportunity. And you end up either tweaking the market and it just doesn't work. And so the methodologies that people have been using in the past to try to find white space puts a lot of current products at risk. And so you find that there's that dichotomy that it's very hard for people to modify their current products to go after where consumers are actually struggling and want to make progress. And so the jobs framework is really, instead of what I would say a top-down methodology of finding, you know, big categories and then trying to go after them, it's literally starting with a combination of situational context and motivation of why they're actually, what they're trying to accomplish when they're in those moments, and aggregating things up. And so instead of being kind of top down, it's very bottom up oriented. And so as markets get saturated and they get more and more you know, kind of crowded, you find that you need to have different methodologies to look at it. So the other thing is that you get, I think methodologies are a lot of the marketing methodologies are geared towards building large markets as opposed to finding niches and growing them. So I talk about it as being, you know, hatching, you know, a $50 million business versus seeding a business where you will have people migrate to it. And so I think jobs is really more about seeding businesses to find behaviors where people are struggling and want to innovate, as opposed to trying to hatch these big businesses.
Okay, that's a really interesting distinction. I guess it's the seeding versus hatching thing is, I hadn't heard that before, but like that seems to be that would be the key difference between, say, like how a startup could apply this sort of thinking as opposed to how like Coca-Cola could apply this sort of thinking, say.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And it's that's some of the new language. So the other reason why I think we haven't heard a lot of it in the past is primarily because you know, Clay's been using it and promoting it. InnoSight's been doing some stuff. Tony Ulwick, who I haven't met, you know, has been talking about outcome-driven innovation and has some things on that. To me, the I've just been doing it, and working with the people who kind of help develop it. We've just been doing it, and a lot of cases we've been so tied up from a confidentiality perspective that we haven't been really able to write about it because everything we do is usually so confidential. So part of it is that we're actually making very explicit choices to partner with people who will let us publish and write and do those kinds of things. The other thing is that I'm a dyslexic, so it's very difficult for me to read and write. And so I think that's the other thing. So I've now got partners and you know, people to help me articulate some of these ideas, and people like yourself who are willing to talk and interview me on these things are helping as well.
Certainly one thing that I've seen, a lot of ideas can catch on purely through like the appropriate use of words. I've seen, like, I don't know if you've been following like the Lean Startup methodology, which, yep, it's certainly like, whilst there's great ideas there, there's no doubt that the naming of it was crucial because it's being phrased in such a way that everyone loves it. So certainly like the evolution of the nomenclature or the lingo basically that gets used, I think helps really popularize an idea.
Yep, I agree wholeheartedly.
Okay, so I might just go specifically into a couple of the questions that have come at me from readers. So when I explain the idea using the iconic milkshake example, people sort of immediately get it and start nodding their heads, and because it's just a fascinating example. But usually what happens is people leave, and then they come back to me maybe 2 to 3 days later, which is the same question all the time. The question is, like, loosely, Des, how do I know when I stop abstracting? For example, like in the milkshake story, the abstraction stops at like solving the boredom of a long commute, but we could have gone further and said, well, a faster car would also solve the commute, or a better commute, or a different job would solve the commute. And if we abstracted shorter, like a bigger milkshake might also do it.
Right.
Is it easy to make this distinction about when you know you've actually identified your job that your product solves?
So the short answer is no, it's not necessarily easy, but I think at the same time, it's the place that I stop is usually when I can find what I call adjacent categories of where I'm stealing from, because part of the notion is that you don't, you know, when people are growing a category, I actually believe that there is no like real growth. It's that you're stealing from some other category that's an artificial category we put together. So the notion is that podcasts are stealing from magazines, and people are buying less magazines and books because they can listen to podcasts. And so it's looking at it and being able to understand the adjacencies from the consumer side. So everything, I mean, the jobs approach is really, I'll say, it's not that unique. I think there's a lot of people like at IDEO and some people in industrial design who have an empathetic type methodology of being able to understand you know, why are people choosing, but it's literally being able to sit in the consumer's eyes and see through their, you know, see through their eyes, feel what they feel, listen, you know, hear what they hear, and understand what's their true consideration set. So it's not, it's really not about abstracting it to beyond what, boy, they're thinking about a new car to get the, make the commute faster. It's what's in the consumer. So in the Rewired group, we talk about the notion of demand side innovation, and that consumers are the ones who are innovating and struggling. And so we stop abstracting when consumers actually can't think about it.
Sure.
And so if they're not thinking, so it's all about actually getting into their head and understanding their what they're struggling with, those big struggling moments where they're looking for something new, understanding their consideration sets from their perspective, not from a categorical perspective, and then being able to understand how far can you go before they literally won't believe whatever you have as a solution, and then how do you actually make sure that you can fit in their consideration set?
Sure, okay. That's clear.
So like if you're thinking about software, it's like, you know, and you talk about Word, it's you know, if you want to write something down, it's what else are they going to use to capture their thoughts? And so you're not going to go to something, you know, real broad, but at the same time, you want to be able to realize that, you know, Word does compete with an audio recorder in some circumstances, and it does compete with paper and pen, and it does compete with, so it's not just software it competes with, it's how would I use it, and how am I hiring it or not hiring it based on the situations I'm trying, what I'm trying to do.
So sticking with Word then, like when it, what do you do, like when a product like literally does one more than one job, like so taking a milkshake, like obviously one role is to taste good with a burger, another could be the commuter role, another could be like the fodder role. Like I totally buy into this idea that's put forward in the paper, like that, you know, if you aggregate and average, you'll get this one size fits none point. But so would you advise like products should, like when they find themselves in a circumstance where different people are using them for entirely different reasons, should they consider like splitting the product or just the same product with different branding? Or
so this is that's a great question. So this is one of the things that we've been wrestling with and how to articulate. But so my background is an engineer, and the difference between like an engineer and a scientist is an engineer's job is to make something work economically so the company that you work for makes a profit. And so it's all about managing trade-offs. And so to me, every product that's designed can do multiple jobs. And so it really gets back to at what point do you actually have a conflict between one job and another and the performance of wanting to go fast and say save gas mileage? And then how do you make sure that people would not buy when you violate that? So we talk about these things called the lines of integration.
Sure.
And they go that most people integrate along attributes or benefits or even customer segments or categories. And what we try to do is integrate along the lines of value from how are the people measuring that it's doing the job. And when you find a conflict between the doing one job and doing another job, to see if you can actually separate the mechanisms of how you deliver it, that's the thing that helps decide whether I say, okay, I'm trying to build a word processor for let's say the medical device or medical community versus education, and if you're trying to and you understand that one values that it's got to be, you know, correct, I can dictate to it, I can do all these things, and so they're going to have a different value code than the student side, then I would separate them into two different products. But if I can actually find a way to do both and not compromise, then I would separate it apart. So it's finding those conflicts of interest and conflicts of value proposition to be, and not from a benefit perspective, but from a performance perspective. So jobs is really about being able to understand the mechanisms of value. How does what's the transformation the consumer is trying to get done, and how do they measure that it's doing what they want it to do?
Sure.
And so those things.
Okay, cool. And then
is that too deep? I don't know if I.
No. That's great. Like, so then a follow up question, like the software engineer in me sort of says, what about the situation? I mean, where you build, say, like a framework or a base level product and then offer like plugins. So this is typical in software where like you can buy a typical offering and then you can, you know, specialize per vertical with like by selling plugins for each individual thing, whether like, you know, whether it's a, you know, a game programming plugin for Visual Studio, or even right now I'm talking to you, I'm using a call recording plugin for Skype. Whereas,
right.
like, you know, Is that something you see as being like wise in terms of product strategy?
Exactly. So Clay and I talk about modularity all the time. So one of the things that actually makes things more disruptive is that a lot of times what happens is people over-engineer the product and it includes too many features. And so what happens is it's not just a cost aspect, it's a complexity aspect of, you know, this is too hard to figure out, I'm not going to use it. And so the more that you can make it modular and understand the situations people are going to use it and have them value it, you actually are going to be able to create more, like, so for example, you can create the platform and then have, you know, plugins be the modularity to customize it to different jobs. And that's but it's really about getting down to, you know, in the software side, they always talk about use cases, right?
Yeah.
And maybe even they might talk about personas, but yeah. The whole thing is that what you're trying to really do is get down to situations where people value the same kinds of things in performance and they're searching for the same kinds of things. And so it's looking at it both from the physical side of the use case, but it's the emotional and social sides that you have to lay on top of it that's usually missing from use case kind of analysis. So that's what Jobs to be Done is really about, is because when you hire somebody, you hire an employee, you're looking at, you know, the social and emotional sides as well as can they do the job.
And so how do you see when you say, if you go for the modularity approach or like in software, like plugins or whatever, is that where you sort of see the role of the endorser brand, where you've got like this parent brand, whether it's like Microsoft Windows or it's iOS, where it itself is really just a gateway towards other jobs that you really want to do? Is that, you know, do you need to like build your brand around this idea, this sort of more slightly abstract idea then?
Yeah. So, I subscribe or have been using pretty much David Ocker's approach to branding, where we have an endorser brand, a driver brand, a descriptor brand, and an ingredient brand.
Okay.
And so it gets back to the job that the brand is. Endorser is basically saying that you fall in this area. So I always think of like a ThinkPad as an endorser brand, IBM is the endorser brand. ThinkPad is the driver brand, which is, you know, I'm looking for a laptop. I'm looking for this kind of thing. The ingredient brand is really kind of like the W510 or whatever that is. And then you're gonna have Intel inside or with Windows 7 are the ingredient sides that really kind of make the packs together. The important part of branding, and again, being an engineer, it's like I took me a long time to really appreciate and understand that most new purchases and switching happens in the mind. And so you have to be able to articulate and shorthand for them to actually try something before. And so the words have to help them. The better you organize those words, the better that they're able to see you as a candidate to help them solve that problem they're looking for.
Okay, cool. And then so in terms of like as a product evolves, would it shift from like being one of those things to like, you know, like does it involve like a new product? Like as a product matures, it might go from being, say, like a ingredient all the way up to possibly being like an endorser.
That's correct.
Is that possible? Yeah.
Yeah, I think as, and what you have to be able to understand is the language that the consumer or the user is utilizing it for, and that, so for example, we're called the Rewired Group, but at the end of the day, when we're working at clients, you find we're the Rewired Guys, and so at some point in time, you know, the group has gone away, and our ultimate brand is Rewired, and so as much as we have all these other words around it, you know, I'm Bob Mesta, then that's maybe the driver, but the Rewired is kind of like that's the bigger brand to me. So they do evolve, and you just need to recognize it. And again, brand managers know how to manage that, and if you want to extend it. But the language is very crucial to being able to help understand what problems you solve and why they hire you.
Like most of the great Jobs to be Done work I see talks about using the job as the unit of analysis from a point of view of improving something, whether that's a milkshake or a car or whatever. And for a startup, like say, even ourselves in Intercom, maybe like 12 months ago, we had a vague idea of something that we knew would be quite useful to people. But we certainly didn't have a job, or at least we didn't. There was no easy way to study how people were currently doing this. How would you propose a startup who most of our listeners will be startups, how would you propose if they wanted to take sort of a first dipping their toes in the water of applying this line of thinking, how would you propose they go about it?
So one of the most important points for us is to understand what we call struggling moments. And so it's the point in time when the user or the buyer is taking a minute to kind of say, you know, there's got to be something better. Sure. And so what you find is that it gets back to what we call the switching mechanism, is that a lot of people can design a great product. I mean, it's better than all the competition. It's lower price than all the competition, but it never takes off.
Sure.
And when you really start to look at those, you know, and understand why they don't take off, it gets back to people aren't understand, you know, at some point they're not struggling enough to want to switch. Or the ability to switch is too high, or the fact is that they're actually not thinking about you. And so to me, it's with every startup, we always start with the notion of who is struggling with what and why are they, what are they looking for to switch? And so as much as you say, boy, I want to build the best, technology startup blogcast in the world, the reality is that are people actually looking for more? Are they actually switching and stopping to listen to somebody else versus listening to you? And so for example, one of the things we would ask is, so let's talk to people. What I would want to do is talk to people is to say, tell me about the last time you found a new blog or something that you started to read, and tell me about a time when you stopped reading a blog. So I can understand the switching behavior of how did they know that it was time to switch? And two, how did they pick the new blog? And what was the criteria? And so what you find is there is a hiring process that they go through. They might look at five or six of them. And so part of this really understanding the change of how people, you know, move, not what they like. So part of it is a jobs to be done framework is really not about, you know, how well they like something. It's really about why would they switch. So it comes back to like talking to people about Tide. If you ask people about Tide and why they use Tide, they make it up. To be honest, they literally just make it all up. But if you actually ask somebody who switched from Tide or switched to Tide, they tell you very specific reasons why they switched and what was the situational context of when they started to think about it and actually choose and pick and choose something else. And that's where the opportunities always lie there.
When you identify these hiring and firing pieces, along with like knowing that that's a job to be done, that's also like a great, it's great information from a customer acquisition point of view, because that actually identifies the time at which you want to engage a customer or advertise or promote your product. Is that?
That's right. So in the housing side, basically I built 1,000 homes in 3 years. When the market was on its way down almost 60%, we were up 20%. And the notion was how many people want to move but can't. And by understanding where they were coming from and what was going on, we moved ourselves from being a builder of new homes to helping people move. And when we reframed ourselves that way and understood the moments of when they choose, how they choose, and what they choose, we were able to actually reduce our costs of both advertising and being in the right place. But to be honest, we were able to take our product down market and make more margin. So the whole thing of understanding when people switch and what's holding them back from switching and, you know, where they're dissatisfied is very, very important.
So you to some degree, you shift what you're selling from bricks and mortar or land to being we sell relocation, if you like. You know, when you're framing this, people know that there's houses out there they could buy, but they're choosing not to buy them because it's sounds difficult.
That's right. Or that they don't think they can get rid of their old house. And what we would do is we'd find people who want to move. And they couldn't afford our house, but they could afford the house that the other person wanted, was willing to sell. So we would actually help people move into somebody else's house so the other person could buy our house. And so it was this big chain of being able to understand how to help people move that changed, you know, kind of what. So for example, if you got people in focus groups, they tell you want stainless steel furniture and hardwood floors and, you know, all these features and benefits that nobody ever, you know, in the end, I'd build the house and nobody buy it. And what I found out is that if I included moving or like a divorced mom, if she literally they would split the furniture, I'd include furniture, you know, basically, you know, from IKEA in it. I literally would sell more homes because that's what they. And so it's those kinds of things where we understand what people are going through and what job they're trying to get done. It's the subtleties and the details and the trade-offs that they're willing to make that we need to incorporate into our product or service.
Sure. So it's like that perfect pairing of problem with solution, right? Like.
That's right.
Yeah.
And not too much, because again, you can there's some people who feature load, and like, you know, when you go test concepts, what you find is that, you know, and this is where I think why Jobs is coming out again lately, is that people end up feature loading concepts, and people will only say, you know, they ask in a way of a future orientation of, do you like the product and would you buy it? And they just keep adding more and more features until they say, yeah, sure, I'd buy it. In the Jobs framework, we actually never talk to anybody who wants to buy, ever. We only talk to people who have bought, because embedded in their choice set is the value code of what they're willing to switch from and to, so we don't over-engineer the product.
That is fascinating. That's a really interesting take that certainly I believe the world of startups could learn from, is that rather than like talking about hypothetical markets of like would-be consumers, looking at people who have consumed and are dissatisfied, or even are satisfied, but like right. by looking at the actual consumption rather than the hypothetical, I think there's a lot the startup world could take from that, because so much of what's advised is like, you know, you build an early rough beta, send it out, see what people think, see if they're interested. Whereas, like, that's not really the right question to ask an awful lot of time.
That's exactly right, and especially when you give it to people. The thing is that you don't have the value code embedded in it. So that's even the worst part, is that people will do beta tests. And my thing is that the beta test should be, it's good for this period of time, and then make them pay. Because if you make them pay, they're now willing to understand the value code of what they're willing to give up. Because otherwise, they're going to critique you for stuff that they'd never pay for. It's brutal. Yeah. I mean, I the software world is caught up in this feedback of satisfaction, that literally they're improving things that literally nobody's willing to pay for, but people are willing to talk about because it's free. It's why I love the guys at 37 Signals, right? Their whole notion is that we design the product, we use it, and as we use it, the fact is we know it's the best it should be, and people are going to give us all these recommendations, but we can spend all this money improving it, but people will still use it. They're not willing to switch. And when they switch up market to places we don't want to be. What a great business model.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's fascinating, and they're certainly an inspiration for us and many others in that regard. But yeah, like what I really like about the idea of, you know, of addressing like people who are actively consuming, is that it cuts out so much of the sort of, well, on one hand, the sort of, you know, the self-fulfilling feedback, which is like, you know, what feature would you like? Okay, we'll build that. What feature would you like? Okay, we'll it's, you know, when you're doing all that in a free beta, you're not going to tap into real value, in my opinion. I've seen many startups struggle with that.
And so most people say, well, we need to have a concept before we test. And I'm like, no, you don't.
Yeah.
And they say, oh, no, we need to have the concept done. It's got to be perfect beforehand. I said, no, give me what you have. And they're like, no, we can't do that. My thing is, give me what you have, and I'll go find people to talk about it that I'll be able to understand the value, because I can only talk to people who are struggling in that moment and are looking for something similar, and when you throw it in that moment, you'll find out what you really need to do. And 9 times out of 10, you don't need to change that much, and the things you want to change aren't the things they want to change. It's a very interesting, you know, you need to be able to frame when you're doing concept testing. We don't do it in groups. You do it on one-on-one, and you make sure you do it in the context of them choosing and consuming. You can't go, you know, how much do you like, you know, spaghetti? And it's like, compared to what? And it's like, well, I had steak and spaghetti. And so you're averaging all these experiences that don't let you understand that spaghetti is the Wednesday night meal that, you know, as we come together as a family and you know, we do it every Wednesday. I mean, all of a sudden there's a whole bunch of different things around it. So when I eat spaghetti at a restaurant, do I like it as much as I like it at home? Heck no. But it's just law. Those important subtle details are lost.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the kind of the fallacy of an awful lot of the user testing. I mean, people boast about how in context their user testing labs are, like where they fake like a, you know, a room in a studio to look like a real family living room, and they hand out these like tablets, devices, and sort of see, oh look, they're responding really well, and because they're sitting on a real couch, it means that it's exactly like you're going to react at home, whereas like at home their dog is barking, and you know, there's just other things changing, like
So I laugh because I as we get kind of new clients, I always go and spend time usually if it's a consumer package good, I spend like hours in the aisle watching people buy. And you can watch when somebody's like looking for the product, but they can't find it, versus somebody who's willing to switch because they're looking, they're picking up the bottles or picking up the cans or picking up the product. And so literally you can see how hard it is for the consumer to switch based on spending 4 or 5 hours in the aisle. So the whole thing is that it gets back to some ethnography and being able to watch and question people, not on what they want, but understand what they're trying to do and why in the world would they be switching? Because if everything's fine, they wouldn't switch.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's kind of reminds me of the whole Google Plus versus Facebook thing. I mean, there's a lot of different things that have been written about that. But I mean, what's certainly clear to me was that by chasing Facebook's tails, it's really, really hard to motivate a switch, especially when you have all these like ties, such as your existing network and all that sort of stuff.
Right. But there's some unique things that it does that actually, you know, eventually it's addressing some of the what I call the non-consumption moments where, you know, I want to tweet something, but I don't want everybody to see it.
Yeah.
And so Google's actually built the whole circle notion to kind of say, well, you want to only tweet this to certain people, you can do that. And so all of a sudden it's really kind of changed that notion of, you know, how do you make sure that what you're putting out there isn't seen by the whole group, but only by a certain subset. It's in the beginning it would say, well, head to head it's not there, but if you actually start to think about how many times you want to tweet something and you don't, you start to realize that that's where the opportunities are of what we call non-consumption, where people want to do something but they don't. I think it's an important dimension that it might change behavior. I think it might have a little harder time for adoption, but you'll see it's like Siri. How many times did my keyboard come up and I'd say, oh, I'm not gonna send that text because I gotta type it. Yeah. Now that I have Siri and I can talk it, I literally text probably, you know, 100%, 200 or 300% more in a day because I can talk my text. Siri is one of those products that have really gone after what we call non-consumption, where people struggle and they weren't anything else to hire, they just wouldn't do it.
Exactly. I think like Siri's use case is fascinating for things like reminders, where like the problem, like software has existed to remind me at 6 o'clock to bring, you know, to take my jacket to the dry cleaners or whatever. That sort of software has existed forever, but it's never been worth it for me to actually go through a UI and do that. But to instantly do it with Siri, like remind me when I leave to bring my keys home.
Right.
It's just perfect. Like, and it's a great example of non-consumption.
Right, and you're not going to get consumers to articulate it because they never want to know that, let anybody know they didn't do it.
Yeah, true.
So unless you know how to get at those non-consumption opportunities, they're very subtle. But to be honest, there's a lot more non-consumption in the world than we think. I mean, people want to do things and they just choose not to, and you'd be surprised. You'd be very surprised.
Okay, so I guess I better not take too much more of your time. There's a lot of deep thinking in the work you've done and the publications you put out there. Am I right in saying there's a book coming out on this topic?
So I've been helping Clay and Max Wessel and a couple people at the Harvard Business School write a book. Scott Anthony is also part of it. So
sure.
I'm just trying to provide some examples behind it. But one of the things that we're working on right now is an online course that will be 6 to 8 weeks long, and it's going to be a combination of asynchronous, where we talk about the actual nuts and bolts of trying to do it. So we're trying to really. So Clay has really kind of pushed me to say, you know, I need to create a legacy and help people really take this stuff to heart. So we're in the early stages of building this this course. So. So as we get that going, it will be interesting to see how entrepreneurs, you know, and trying to make sure it's priced in a way that entrepreneurs can take it and use it and do something with it. So we're working on that kind of, because we know that there's a lot of struggling at that level, and there is people who want to apply it but can't. So we're applying our principles to what we do.
Sure. And in terms of, I mean, obviously we'll link up your, I think, BeamOesta on Twitter. Obviously people can follow you there, and they'll be able to keep tabs on most of what you're up to, I presume.
I travel quite a bit. I'm on Foursquare, so if I'm around, if I have a night where I'm in Chicago, Boston, sometimes I get to Ireland, the UK. I think I'm going to Lisbon pretty soon.
Nice.
But my thing is I always try to make sure I've got one night free just to kind of say, hey, I'm available. And, you know, we'll get 15, 20 people around just talking about it. So if you see me around, I'm always willing to share.
Sure. And do you speak at conferences whatsoever, or are you available to do that? Is that something you do?
I am. I'll say I did quite a bit of it before. I particularly like to work on projects, but at the same time, if there are conferences where people think I can be of value, it really is. I like more very focused conferences. So to me, it's I don't like to talk in general. I really like to talk in specific. So the, sure. the tighter the audience, the more fun I have with it. So I am available to do that always.
Sure. Okay. Well, listen, thank you so much for your time, Bob. We really appreciate it. And I'll be sure to link up all of your material, the Rewired group, your Twitter account, all that sort of details in the show notes. Thank you so much for your time. This has been an absolute pleasure of mine.
Thank you.